If you've eaten a blueberry in the past couple of months, the likelihood is it came from Peru. Just over 10 years ago, in 2012, Peru didn't export blueberries at all. But now it's a global leader in blueberry exports. How did that happen? How did the industry come to employ an estimated 135,000 people during the growing season? That's what we're going to be talking about today, including the specific steps that the Peruvian government took, and the lessons that were learned about the bottlenecks to pursuing high-value agriculture. This is Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast about economic research and policy, and I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev.
And I'm Karthik Akhileshwaran, co-founder of Growth Teams. And in this mini-series, we're learning about sector success stories from Latin America, Africa, and Asia, directly from the policymakers who helped to make them happen. Today, we'll hear about blueberries, grapes, asparagus, avocados, mangoes, and more importantly, about the tools Peru used to become a global leader in exporting these high-value fruits and vegetables. Joining Oliver and me to discuss this story is Piero Ghezzi, who was a minister of production in Peru during this period of transformative sectoral growth. Piero, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure being here.
Piero, before getting into your time as minister, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your route into politics.
Well, after finishing my PhD, I spent many years in financial markets, first in New York and then in London. I worked for Barclays in London. In 2013, I came back to Peru, after having spent 20 plus years abroad. A couple of years before, I kept observing Peru very much, and realized that even though the country was one of the fastest growing economies in Latin America, top two, top three, it had not engaged in the virtuous cycles that are normally associated with development in terms of strengthening of institutions, strengthening of human capital. And it looked to me and a friend whom I wrote a book, Jose Gallardo, that this was more of an episodic growth. So even though the establishment in Peru, if you wish, were really extrapolating and saying that Peru was going to become a developed economy over so many years, we realized that even though the macro was very strong, the microeconomics were not as strong. And that was validated by the fact that in 2011, two non-establishment candidates moved to a second round of elections. If things were so great in Peru, why did people didn't vote for the establishment candidates, no? And so in 2013, I came, I wrote a book, and as a result of the book, they invited me to become a production minister, no? In Ministry of Industry, SMEs, etc. No? I am a technocrat, so I would not consider myself a politician. I'm not certainly a politician, but there's a political aspect in the roles I play, no?
And you mentioned that you co-authored this book on Peru's development challenges. What was the core diagnosis that you brought with you into government?
From what we were saying there is, first, we need to make some adjustment to the development model that Peru was implementing. Not cosmetics, but just really try to be a little more aggressive with some industrial policy. Because, again, we were not engaged in self-fulfilling or self-reinforcing positive dynamics in the country. And that sooner or later, things were going to slow down because some of the drivers of growth during the previous years were exhausting, right? And that was proved to be right. And your stuff was that even though when I joined, there was the president back then had this idea of an industrial plan. One of the things I said is that instead of talking about just manufacturing industry as a source of growth, we should focus on more productive diversification, because it's obvious to us that as important as how what you do is how you do it, right? And there's a lot of industries with a manufacturing-like characteristics, like agro exports, right? Where you could have really the productivity gains and the learning, the capability generation that you have in traditional in manufacturing. And so let's say broaden and not be too specific about just industry, no? And also remember that Peru, as many countries in Latin America, had this aversion to industrial policy. Pedro Malan, famously, the minister of Fernando Enrique Cardoso, said, no, the best industrial policy is non-industrial policy. No, it's the best you can have is not have at all. You just need all these horizontal, transversal policies. Very much Washington consensus, because that experience of industrial policy in Latin America has not been as the one in Asia. So it hasn't been that successful. And so it was a kind of a bad name. So much so that industrial policy in our region, in Latin America, is not called industrial policy. It's normally called productive development policies, right? It's an euphemism to talk about the same. But give you the opening, and right, the name gives you also the opening to talk about other sectors other than just manufacturing industry.
Great. So you arrive in government in 2014, and along the lines of what you just mentioned, one of your first actions is to reorient the Ministry of Production to combat slowing productivity growth in Peru. Then comes implementation of this new strategy. You met various consultants and international organizations who offered to create an implementation plan for you. Yet you declined and instead innovated a new approach that came to be called mesas ejecutivas, or executive roundtables. Why did you take this route? And could you explain as simply as possible what these mesas involved and the problem they were trying to solve?
Yeah, I think that the consultancy part is correct. I mean, have a couple of consultancy firms offering what they were doing, they had done in our neighbors and other countries. Then the ADB actually was very helpful, because they had launched a book in 2014, the same year that I joined. And they came, Ernesto Stein and José Miguel Benavente, in that moment they were at the IDB, came to talk to us about some of their ideas. But a few things happened. Now, why did we reject this plan that these consultancy firms were offering? First, because these standard tools of having very exhaustive diagnosis, no, with prescriptions and very detailed roadmaps, right? Normally don't work for development, because it doesn't have the flexibility to contemplate the uncertainties, the coordination failures, no, the technological change, etc. There's normally a lot more associated to development, no? That's the one thing. The second thing is that times in government are short, right? It was, let's say, I joined in February. We're talking about May, June 2014, and government finished in 2 years. Had we followed the advice of these consultancies, they could have taken like a year or more to write a diagnosis. So we would have had no time to implement. And so implementation was key for us, no? So there was a political reality and some ideas of why this stuff doesn't work. No, so we decided, instead of taking that route, we convened to the private sector stakeholders of some key sectors, right, to engage in working groups. And then that was the second part that is very important, which is we analyzed the working groups that were traditionally utilized in government. And it's used in almost in every country in Latin America. You have these mesas de trabajo, mesas de diálogo, mesas, the tables from different, right, type of mesas, no? But none of them work. It was like the track record was terrible. So we analyzed what these mesas typically were doing, and we did just the opposite. For example, no? They did not engage with the private sector. Maybe they invite them once, The president comes, talks about the problems, and then they leave. But there is no process of co-creation of solutions with the private sector. Second, the public sector stakeholders are not the ones that have their knowledge in these messes, the knowledge or the competences, right? The responsibilities to implement. Just is one designated official of one public entity who has no idea about the issues and goes to these messes, right? So as a result of that, you had 250 plus grupos de trabajo, mesas o comisiones multisectoriales that were being utilized. There was this rigidity of sessions and no team. For example, there was no team with that capabilities to make things happen. You had just guys who were taking notes and setting as an agenda, but without really articulating a process. So basically, we said, okay, let's work on a new type of mesa that has some unique characteristics. First, a productivist approach. Second, an emphasis on execution, right? Third, very iterative, right? As opposed to being a linear process, really more of a iterative, dynamic iterative process where what we learn during execution allows us to enrich our initial diagnosis. Now, and fourth, and very importantly, and maybe the most important element of the mesa, is to have a dedicated team. Normally, what these groups in government had everywhere was that one public sector official was also in charge of these different commissions or working groups, but it was one of the 40 things they have to do. Right, so in our case, we hired people to just do that. Maybe not the only thing that they do, the mesas, our mesas, but the most important thing they do. So as a result of, and we really focus a lot on getting things on, not spend a lot of time in huge diagnosis, but from the beginning, some quick wins, a combination of right stuff that where we could obtain significant results in the short term. And also working towards some more important medium-term objectives. And the own private sector that participated in the mesas says, look, these mesas are very different from the mesas we're used to participate. These mesas are very ejecutivas. So a result of that is the private sector baptized them as mesas ejecutivas. It was not our creation. So in a way, was a combination of listening carefully. Our mesas was a combination of listening carefully to a private sector, seeing what had not worked right in the past with all these working groups and commissions and do just the opposite, and have very good public sector officials with a different mentality, with a problem-solving mentality that allow us to really create the mesas ejecutivas. But to be honest, we started towards the end of 2014, the first mesas ejecutivas. And only a year and a half later, or 14 months later, we realized how unique the stuff we had created it was. So we did not realize. It was until Chuck Sable with Ernesto Stein came to Lima in January 2016 that I had dinner with them. And Chuck had written a paper for an ILO conference that he was talking about this experimentalist governance, right? That he writes about, and it looked at he was talking about mesas, well, and he had no idea about mesas, and I had no idea about the literature that Chuck had been writing about. So it was shocking to me. I had written a 15-20 pages. Write up about our experience in mesas. I gave it to him, and when we had dinner, he had written over the place, and they were super interested. So because my background was not in development, right? I was in international finance, was global head of economics at Barclays before coming to government. I was not that familiar with the literature of stuff that both Danny Roderick had been writing about modern industrial policy or certainly stuff that Chuck Sable had been writing. was a result, again, of intuition, listening to people, and having the good luck, of having good public sector officials with a different mentality. That's how they. So I don't know if I answered your question, but that's how they came out.
I was wondering, in light of the fact that you mentioned there have been past efforts, numerous past efforts, at some form of mesas or coordinating bodies, etc., many of which had failed, how did you get people to participate at first, given that this was a new approach?
I would make a distinction. We were, you know, I was talking to officials and private sector from other countries. Now I'm talking like recently, and they did have very attempts of public-private coordination, right, or dialogues, right? That basically after a while, because there were no achievements, yeah, the private sector is tired of keep going to those invitations and they are tired, right? So here is different. We're talking Peru 2014. As I said, these comisiones was more within the public sector that sometimes sometimes they invited the private sector to speak once, but there was not a process, they were not that often invited in general, right? Whereas here, what we did is, okay, first, we're going to do it this by demand. Let's start. I had 1 week. And I said to different gremios, right, associations, private sector associations, come up with sectors that you would like us to prioritize, as opposed to we deciding which sectors to grow. So basically, they came with 4 or 5 sectors at the beginning that the guys associated, organized themselves and came to ask for opening a mesa, right? So the first thing was, it was not some, sometimes government is ministers want to push an idea over the private sector, but there's no demand. So they come once or twice just to be nice or to be polite. But if they don't care, this is not a mission state. So we did the opposite, right? We just ask them what you would like us to, right, work on. And so the first thing is these invitations where we started with the sectors that demanded to participate in this co-creation. And second, quick wins. There's no alternative to have logros, right? Quick wins, right? So they saw that the dynamic was not just to sit down and just talk endlessly to ventilate frustrations, right? And to just to talk, but just to really solve to solve problems. So for the private sector, this was not too, it was easy to engage them because they really wanted to work in this sort of dynamics and they were seeing from the very beginning how different it was. So we did something counterintuitive that I think is right at the same time, which is we did not start creating all this paraphernalia, all these institutions, all these right comisiones and all these Gran Comisión Nacional de la Diversificación Productiva. So we really start doing stuff, and in the process, we formalize it. But we did not spend 1 year creating all this institutional setup and governance and then start to do things. We did first, and that made a big difference. Now, the problem at the beginning was a little bit more with the public sector officials, right? With the private sector, it's very easy to get them engaged. With the public sector officials, it was a little bit more different because we are, my ministry is a ministry of industry and fishing with some transversal responsibility like MSMEs, no? Like micro, pequeño MIPES, right? MSEs, no? So we started working about forestry, agro exports, aquaculture, right, tourism, stuff that was not the former responsibility of my ministry. So you run the risk of having some passive or actually active resistance from guys who are saying, why are you, right, entering into my territory, right? So we had, I would say, a couple of advantages and stuff that we did. The first is that I really had a very strong relationship with the Minister of Finance, which is a guy with the money, with the budget, right? And that that helps a lot. I think like a lot of these efforts of doing this MESA type of work fail because are just initiatives from ministers of industry without the participation of the Minister of Finance. So they really are very limited because a lot of the coordination problems happen within the public sector. So to induce cooperation of public sector entities, they need to believe that they win something, they gain something, right? So to have the Minister of Finance who can actually induce cooperation through the allocation of budget really helps a lot. And I was super close to a Minister of Budget, and because of my background, right? I was chief economist of Barclays globally, so I'm more of a finance guy than a typical development guy. I had a lot of credibility with a Minister of Finance, right? With it was a personal friend, the minister, but also all the public sector officials or the Minister of Finance, right below, were guys who knew who I was, etc. So that was good. But in addition to that, we were very careful to be respectful of the fact that the guys, when something happens, something good happens, the guys who gain the rewards, the guys who get recognized, are the public sector officials from the other entities. So the MESA team or producer, my ministry, was not the one to shine. The other guys shine. If something good happens, it's because the Ministry of Agriculture, the Ministry of Tourism, the public sector officials there were the ones who did it. So they did not feel that they were basically being undermined or anything like that, just the opposite. We are helping you to shine. And that, I think, overcame a lot of the passive resistance. And there's something more interesting because, as you may know, I finished in 2016, and the MESAs, one way or another, have continued for many years since then. And one of the lessons, I would say, also is that over time, that process of public-private collaboration and problem solving and right of creation of solutions actually helps reducing the barriers, because there's a lot of mistrust between the public sector and the private sector. Within the public sector, between the, let's say, the more social, environmental, right, ministries and more productive ministries like mining, agriculture, or industry, right? From big enterprises to small enterprises. So the process of sitting down over years and years, working on solutions, actually allows a convergence of views, because they start to realize at the end, the public sector guys who are in the mess are not just lazy bureaucrats who just are corrupt, are guys who actually want to get things done, and as public sector realizes also that private sector who participate are not just lobbies that just care about money, but that are really looking to improve things, right? So this idea of doing the correct thing and having a sort of a mission allows this convergence of views in which that basically allowed more continuity, which is particularly important in a country that had, I think, 8 presidents since I left. No, so the institution, the continuity really is very tough to maintaining with, I don't know, 15 finance ministers since I left, stuff like that. It's just crazy. Peru is crazy, which actually is a good thing for the instrument. It's terrible for Peru. It's a good thing in terms of testing the resilience of the instrument, because if it has been able to survive to so many presidents and to so many ministers of finance and industry, is there something about the instrument that allows them to have certain continuity and has nothing to do with having Mesas in a law has a lot to do with what private sector demand.
So Kartik and I opened this podcast talking about fruits and vegetables. To start with, could you tell us a bit about the specific bottlenecks in those areas which firms raised to the government through these MESAs?
Right. Okay. So let's be clear here. The Mesa Exportadora helped the sector, but the sector takeoff started before the MESAs, right? So let's talk about but in a way they were working with the MESA type mentality. In 2013, I participated in a Conferencia Nacional de Ejecutivos. It's an annual meeting of executives, right? Of CEOs, etc., right? And that was a few months before becoming minister. And the main, so there were different sectors talking, and basically did not include the public sector. Basically, all the sectors of finance, mining, whatever, were talking about stuff they were going to do without government. Government is a failure. It doesn't work. It's a disaster. We, the private sector, are right the heroes and the ones who are going to right take the country to the next level without government, right? But the agro and a lot of very articulated, the smart people, etc. And then it came the agro exportadores, right? The agro sector was totally the opposite. Were the least articulated guys because they are agricultores, right? They are they were not used to speak in big forums, but really had a very close cooperation with them. They brought the Minister of Agriculture, they brought SENASA, which is a phytosanitary entity. So and they really had been working together already for many years, because it doesn't matter how good I am as an exporter of blueberries and a producer of blueberries, if I don't have the market of China open, I cannot export to China. So I need and the only guy who actually does that is the government through SENASA, the Phytosanitary Authority. So you really need a continuous process of public-private collaboration in agro-industry, which is different maybe from some other sectors in a way. So that really I really always believed in these private-public collaborations, but that process was coming from before. They were already working with a sort of not MESAs exactly, but really had a continuous ongoing collaboration between the public and the private sector that preceded the MESAs, but had a lot of the elements of MESAs. No? Now, but there was also there were a few things that happened, right? You had some irrigation projects that were long dated from the 50s, right? That have been thinking about and came to fruition right in the 80s, right? So basically, you irrigated a desert, some water that was going right to the Amazon River, to the Atlantic Ocean, was diverted to irrigate the desert. So the Peruvian coast that was very desertic suddenly had a lot of water, which is huge. So, second, you have the creation of SENASA, the Phytosanitary Authority, the creation and strengthening of SENASA through this process of private collaboration that I explained in detail before. Then in 2000, there was a agrarian promotion law, very important, because it allowed this sector-specific labor regulations, because as Oliver said earlier, right, during the harvesting season, the sector demands a lot more people. If you use the general labor law in Peru, it would be impossible, because you need people for 2 months, not for 12 months, right? So this seasonality so to deal with that, you had this agrarian law specific to the sector that allowed to hire people, right, for shorter basis, right? So I would say, and then the free trade agreements that allowed to enter markets with low tariffs. No, these four things, the irrigation projects, the strengthening of SENASA, right, the agrarian law, and the free trade agreements, I would say the four main pillars that allowed, right, this sector to boom in a situation where, you know, the natural conditions have been there forever, but the stars aligned in a way, right? And then start first the asparagus, then that actually the asparagus came with USAID financing at the beginning, right? After, remember that Peru had the Shining Path and terrorist groups in the 80s. So one way of to pacify and to create opportunities of develop jobs and production was USAID start to work with some asparagus producers, and then avocados, then grapes, then arándanos, blueberries. That was the ultimate success, right? But was a combination of stuff, of some policies that allowed them to really grow, and were the natural comparative advantage of Peru, right? With all of them, but particularly with blueberries, was just amazing. So a blueberry in Peru grows in 7 months. In Chile or Argentina, they grow in 3 years. So that you can not only have a lot more productivity, but also your learning cycles to adapt the best varieties, etc., are a lot shorter, which allows you to really accelerate the genetic improvements and anything like that you require. And it was crazy because nobody expected to be able to grow blueberries so close to the equator, and with a variety that actually was public. So they were not paying. It was so bad that for the rest of the world, so bad that there were not even royalties for that variety anymore. It had expired. And that was and really ratified what I was talking before about how these farms really were factories, right? Are very different from traditional agriculture, right? The dynamics of the modern agribusiness are super different in terms of, right, the learning cycles, the continuous monitoring, limiting, not eliminating because it's impossible, but limiting to the natural disasters, climate, events, etc., right? These guys are very capable to reduce significantly the impact of that through very active management with irrigation, micro-irrigation with fertilizers, pesticides, whatever. I mean, like, it's a totally different animal than that more traditional agriculture. So they may not be producing iPhones, but they're still a factory. It's a factory for grapes, mangoes, avocados, blueberries, no? And that's what we were talking about before at some point about that, the industrialization of freshness. Because the old development idea was, okay, let's produce a blueberry juice, blueberry marmalade, right? But actually, the sophistication is actually in not to have a raw material for that. The sophistication and the success in agriculture is to have fresh blueberries of top quality that actually can reach China, Europe, or the US, right? And can be imported fresh. So only the stuff that doesn't, right, pass the quality control is the one that gets used to this industrialization, right? The mermeladas or juices, right? So that's it's a totally different mentality, right? The value added, the real value added is not in industrializing. The real value added is in being able to generate a fresh produce with the quality characteristics of flavor, right, shelf life, size, bloom, right, that consumer in the northern hemisphere is demanding, right? So that's the issue, is that it's not so easy to have new blueberries, which is a problem for all, for us developing countries, right? Do we have enough sectors or subsectors that allow to absorb employment, right? And I give you an example, because of course you can always talk about the great things that MESA did or this productive development policy did, because at the end of the day, we had an aquaculture MESA and we focused a lot of efforts on shrimp. And we were really, everything the government had to do was done with everything. But sector really cannot compete with Ecuador because of climate stuff, right? So even though we spent time and resources, particularly in time, to really do everything that we created, SANIPES, which is a SENASA for the aquaculture and fishing industry, right? So it's a, we opened a shrimp market for China. We did a lot, created these different processes for the plants, everything very specific agriculture regulation. Really, at the end of the day, we like to distinguish between my problems and your problems, right? The stuff that the private sector has to do. But if you cannot compete, once I did everything I had to do, that's not something to do, right? Then the only alternative is to subsidize you. Then we're talking about a totally different right approach. We have tried to be very, very, very disciplined in terms of really subsidies, very little subsidies. So it's, in a way, if I'm going to finance, I prefer to finance the strengthening of a public sector entity or provide the public goods that make you more productive, as opposed to compensating you for the fact that that you are not competitive enough. No. And that's a way of thinking that's a policy, and overcome from a political standpoint that the suspicious, right, that's, or the misgivings that many guys had about industrial policy. So if you see, the mesas don't have the typical criticisms that picking winners and subsidizing, right, that industrial policy has, right? We are not in the picking winners sector, at least not because we came from demand. That private sector prioritized in a way. So we did not pick from a, it was not a, an illuminated minister, right, pick the winners, right? The private sector demanded, and then since we were more providing public goods to make you more productive as opposed to direct subsidies, we also didn't have that potential problem. And the fiscal costs were a lot smaller, let's say. I mean, like, that one advantage of mesas is that actually they are fiscally net positive. You spend very little and you actually have information to allocate budget, which is one of the reasons why the finance ministers like that information, no? When they're well done, no? When they're well done. Because of course, at the end, we're talking about an instrument. A mesa is a methodology, no? It's not a mesa is not sitting around a mesa. It's not, is all the stuff you do right during the sessions, and particularly to the intersessions. Everything that happens between a mesa session is also the mesa. Maybe if I had been like smarter in terms of labels, I would not have called them mesas ejecutivas, because people have in mind also more an institution as opposed to a technology. And mesas are foremost a technology, a methodology to solve problems.
You spoke a bit about some aspects that worked and in some cases where they didn't work. How did you measure the success of the MESA's approach?
There are like different ways, right? And we try to be eclectic about it, right? The one that one measure of success for us from the beginning is the fact that people keep coming. No, we are very careful in terms of, I mean, like, you need to see the output, but it's, we want to be always very careful not to have certain metrics that are so rigid that people start to blame the system. So what we did is, okay, if people keep coming every other week for 2 years, it's because they think that they're not wasting their time, right? So that these other commissiones or working groups from government died of natural causes normally, because they work, right? The first time the minister comes and all these other public sector officials and they talk, then nothing happens, and they come again in 2 months. Again, they talk about the same problems. Nothing had happened in the meantime, and then they die naturally, right? Whereas the message continued. The mesas that work continue operating. The mesas that did not work very well because it was a problem, right? Also cease, we cease to operate them, right? So there was a natural, right, information provided the fact that MESAs, that private sector kept coming, and there was over time more and more demand for more MESAs. So the good thing was there has always been an excess demand for MESAs. So the MESAs, the private sector would like a lot more MESAs that realistically can be operated at the same time, right? And second thing is more like, so one thing is that, right, the demand. The second thing is some quantitative, of course, measures in terms of investment. So you had like both quantitative and qualitative measures. We have never been so wedded, right? Of course, again, I'm not in government since 2016. So we're talking about 9 years, right? But it's a combination of stuff where we really wanted to make sure that we do not select criteria so narrow that we do not, right, capture the whole advantages. How do you capture the fact that over time you have some continuity? I talk about, right, the idea that over time, these barriers and mistrust between public sector and private sector, within the public sector, within the private sector, was overcome. The idea of you have generate a vision for the sector that actually survives the administration of the ministers. That has a lot of value because the guy who, particularly in Peru, where you change president every year, no, or you change a minister every few months. If everybody would start from zero, it would be a disaster. When you have a MESA, the MESA already has an agenda, right? A medium-term agenda that has been discussed and has been tested, right? And that has a huge amount of value. I don't know how you measure that. But this is sort of this the institutional and the trust building, right, that you can generate through these processes, right? Of course, again, I'm a believer in the instrument, but in practice, many times, right, even some countries have copied MESAs, right? And not, it hasn't been successful all the time because people try to adapt the stuff to their own realities and sometimes really they are not following the methodology, no? Or they are, they believe MESAs are only for like some norms or changes in regulation as opposed to this more, I think, ambitious agenda, right? That you could have, right? At the end, success depends on many factors, right? One is a tool, but also, no? You could have a great car, but a bad driver, right? And you have a great driver, a great car, but it's a terrible circuit, right? So, it's a combination of stuff that helps with success.
Was there one MESA in particular that stands out where you saw in real time the public and private sectors jointly and successfully overcoming bottlenecks?
Yeah, I mean, like we can talk about many MESAs in particular. Depends what you define as real time, right? If you talk about within a session, right? Like I, many examples, no? But that can be as stupid as the following, no? So in the food industry MESA, the MESA de Alimentos, right? They were talking about the octagons, right? That you use for high sugar, saturated fats, right? That have to be labels, right? In the products, right? They were talking about something else in the MESA. And then the private sector raised a fact that, by the way, DIGESA, which is the SENASA for Alimentos, had issued this right norm 15 days ago where they require us to put an octagon for gluten-free. And that doesn't make sense at all for several reasons. One reason is because these octagons have a negative connotation, right? It's bad for your health. Whereas gluten-free is something that you do just to cover, right, the health of people. And second, there's already an international label. I already use the weed with the cross, right? Diagonal line, etc., right? And so it was crazy that the public sector officials had not realized they had done something totally stupid. And in that precise moment, the Mesa said, okay, we're going to the road, that the directive, we're going to back to using that traditional sign, right? It was fixed immediately. Hadn't been in a Mesa, this thing could have gone on for years, maybe, because nobody would have listened to them, right? Then in the tourist Mesa, for example, tourism, right? We created an airport. So basically there was this city not too far away from Lima, maybe, you know, like this region, right? Maybe 5, 6 hours, 7 hours by car, but they have an airport and the Mesa basically, but there were no direct flights. And the Mesa basically put together the airlines, that public sector, that the public sector officials, the hotels industry, the companies around the area to basically create a new airport, and basically tourism has gone up. Of course, there were no flights, so the tourism was a lot more. Like, then stuff like stuff that you normally do not associate with public sector interventions that are seem crazy, but at the end have a lot of implications. For example, in the mining Mesa, you had that to start explorations, you need to collect some, take pictures to make sure that you are not intervening negatively on the environment, no? And the authority that had to approve those pictures and muestra, I don't know how to say it in English, sorry, was an entity that depended from the Ministry of Agriculture. So within that, and their main objective is just to safeguard the forestry and right some. But among their many responsibilities was to approve this collector muestra for the mining sector for new investment projects. But they had no people, no guidelines, nothing. So there was a huge backlog in this entity that had nothing to do with ministry, but had huge impact on exploration for mining, right? Had nothing to do with mining. And probably the Minister of Agriculture had no idea about what this entity was doing for mining in the search of it. So the Mesa solved that problem. So basically you intervene and basically created guidelines, they staffed with people, and the backlog move from, you know, from 6 months or 8 months to 0 and 300, and exploration in mining went up a lot as a result of that change. The public sector has a lot of ways to fail, right? And that a lot less visible what you normally would think about. I remember I was talking about this example of the mining industry, and Ricardo Hasbaum was saying it has nothing to do with something, right, that you normally associate with, right, with public industrial policy, but it's a lot of industrial policy because you are solving these bottlenecks that are totally invisible to the high-level officials. And I think one of the strengths for me of Mesas is this combination of the private sector, right, or the bottoms-up knowledge from the actors that have, right, that know what's going on in a day-to-day basis, and the public sector guys who have the power to allocate budget, not to convene actors, to solve right disagreements, etc. No, so that helps. And the guys who normally have the power don't have the knowledge, and the guys who have the knowledge don't have the power. And so we try to convene those, and that's that. I think that has worked very nicely. And even within the stakeholders at the, let's say, at the level of the field level. Sometimes the private sector knows their problems, that they don't know the solutions. They don't know really, because their natural instinct is to ask for subsidies. That's normally what the private sector would do. Okay, we have this problem, you need to reduce our taxes, or you need to, no. They don't really have a good understanding of public sector management and right and norms, etc. So the solutions are very simplistic normally. And the public sector normally doesn't have the sector-specific knowledge required to take decisions, informed decisions, right? So even we think that the guys with the contextual knowledge, they really complement a lot and can both create stuff that individually would have never created, no? Without this sort of a venue.
What do you think is Peru's next blueberry? Or what's the process of identifying it? And do you think mesas can play a role in figuring that out?
Okay. I'm not sure there will be easily a new blueberry, okay? Because the blueberry is very special in terms of it grows so fast that, again, the comparative advantages generated by the blueberries are very clear. I don't see, and I think many companies have been trying to understand, to see what that new blueberry may mean. And I would, so your question is actually very deep in the sense that has several answers beyond the fact that there may not be a new blueberry so easily discovered, right? I think like in the agro-export business, you have sufficient enterprises, sufficiently large, modern, successful, and productive as to actually undertake the price discovery or cost discovery process by themselves. I think there will be some reluctance to share each a mesa type environment R&D that they are undertaking to discover the new fruits or varieties of fruits, etc. So I would say I would not. Let me give you an example of cherries. Okay, one stuff that Peru has done very well is to do what Chile was doing and do it better, right? Because just the comparative advantages of Peru are just a lot better. So we did Chile did grapes, Peru did grapes, did better, and we are much larger than Chile. Even in grapes, in avocados, basically, again, and blueberries. Chile is a great exporter of cherries, right? And cherry will be really, and it's really a market where a lot goes to China. It's really a market difficult to, where for Peru to compete because the coast where most of the agro export boom is actually a, doesn't have the ideal climate for cherries that requires really much colder climates. So you need to go to the other side of the mountains, right, of Peru, which are a lot colder, right? But then you don't have that clear comparative advantages, right? So a cherry in the Andean region really is going to, in Peru, is going to grow at about the same rate as in Chile. So you don't have that blueberry difference that we were talking before, right? So I would say no clear comparative advantage, but also I don't think that products, because you have very successful companies like Camposol, Hortifruit, right, Cerro Prieto, Damper, Viru, already very well established. I think they are going to do their RD by themselves. I don't think they're going to be, they don't need, and they will not want to share their knowledge, right? So they all will want to innovate. And in the case of Camposol and Hortifruit, they did the blueberries by themselves pretty much without public sector, right? I mean, like the blueberry price discovery, and they were able to appropriate a lot of the gains. So this idea of appropriability I don't think matters here. They're able to appropriate a lot of the gains. Even now, Camposol, who was a pioneer in blueberries, it has 25-30% of the market. So has really been able to appropriate that of the gains of being the innovator, right? So I would say, in one level, I think the Mesa may not be the best venue for discovering the new blueberry. But once you have a cherry, for example, the cherry doesn't have the market for, you need to overcome the bottlenecks to export cherries to China. For example, you need to open the market for China. You need to improve infrastructure to bring the stuff from the countryside to the coast. That's where the mesas can be very, very useful. That's in the case of agroexport. Now, if we move, let's say, to the Amazon region, right, where you do not have the Peru has like coast, the Andes, right, and then the Amazon rainforest, then you basically do not have the obvious comparative advantages of the agroexports sector. The cost of transportation is a lot larger because you need to cross the Andean, the mountains, and you do not have the established companies, right, that are going to, right, already undertake the R&D by themselves. I think then the Mesa Amazonica in particular is exactly working about what you were talking about, prioritizing, right, the new products and what needs to be done to basically, now that it becomes obvious that you are not going to extract a lot of more wood from the forest, how do you, right, generate value out of the forest and also generate value out of all this deforested stuff. Then with a different industrial organization, if you wish, the mesas may have a much bigger role in selecting and prioritizing products, right? So, and I guess what I'm saying also has the implication that every mesa is very different. You have a methodology that you need to adapt to the different realities, right? In some sectors will be more technical. For example, the mining sector in Peru, you have like a big mining companies, very sophisticated with a very strong association. So a lot of that is what I mean, more like the technical stuff. Other sectors, you have a lot of small companies, more social, right? More political. So you need to work with in different ways, right? More established companies versus less established companies. So you need to adapt this MESA type methodology to the realities, right? They were using MESAs in Chile. They adapted to the reality of Chile. But we have been talking about MESAs, no, in Africa, right? Or El Salvador, right? So the realities are going to be different and the countries are different. And then you need to adapt the instrument that does these different realities. No?
And what do you see as the next set of bottlenecks for Peru to unlock, given its need to raise productivity?
Wow, that's a very tough question, no? I don't think it's only a Peru-specific problem. It's certainly it's a Latin American problem to a large extent, but also global-wise, right? So we have a problem of lack of good jobs, right? And Peru may be emblematic in a way that despite all the growth and all the, right, some of the successes of the last years, you still have 70% unemployment rate. Informality. 70% informality. So in the labor market, right? So you have a lot of, you are clearly not generating enough good jobs in the modern private sector to absorb all these employers, and many of them are in the informal sector. So you need to find tools, right, to on the one hand generate more agro-export type sectors to absorb, right, the labor force, but that will not be enough. I don't think there will be enough sectors with this narrowing of development opportunities in the world, right, to really absorb all the labor force. You really need to do more policies specific to the micro and small enterprises, right, that allows them to engage into a dynamic value chains. So I would say I would like a combination of horizontal, transversal policies and also sector-specific policies that allows, on the one hand, what we would call the productive transformation, right, of this, letting that these more medium-sized or high or large modern enterprises grow and absorb labor force. And then a second, productive inclusion that allows some of the MSCs to participate to dynamic value chains, right? Now, I think what I've learned over the last years is that not all problems have solutions. There's the problems that don't have solutions, right? And we need to accept that. And that even those that have theoretical solutions may not be politically feasible. So for a country like Peru, with this institutional fragility, right, with this political fragility where you have been changing presidents every 1 or 2 years over the last 10 years with this fractured Congress, right, it's very difficult to really to do the sort of stuff I described in the first, right now, in the last minutes, right? So, again, some problems don't have solutions, but even they have may not be implemented. So I'm not a guy who thinks we need to have zero corruption and a Singapore-like government to grow, right? We know that at the end, development is virtuous cycles that allow that growth, it generates resources and allows to strengthen institutions, and that generates more growth in the future. But I think we have this understanding that we don't have to have a perfect starting condition. I think that the political conditions are so weak that it really goes against gravity. Now, Latin America in general, right, has the same productivity problem that I described. I mean, like with exception, I think of Uruguay, you have that if you do a regression, right, where you have GDP per capita and informality, all Latin Americans are above the regression line, right? So you have, o sea, for the same level of per capita GDP, we have a lot higher informality compared labor informality compared to, and you have many more like MSCs in Latin America. So you need to address that, right? And also the sort of policies you need for the MSCs have to be different, because the one risk is that you do this sector like size specific policies that actually perpetuate enanism, right? So you need to have policies that by their very nature need to generate the incentives to grow. That's the reason I like the idea of these value chains, right? Subsidizing, right, the combination of anchor companies with small suppliers, right? So the one issue we have been working on recently is how to generate more dynamic value chains in agro-exports, including small producers, because a lot of the agro-export boom has been with large companies, medium and large companies. And how do you generate the incentives for the small producers to join these dynamic value chains? And I think then you need to really reduce the cost of transaction cost for the large and for small companies to work together. No? And the advantage of this collaboration is that it has embedded the improvement in quality and productivity that you want to avoid enanism. Because a small guy that to keep getting the standards required to export needs to keep improving, and right, it's gonna be stagnated, no? So I think you need to reiterate policies for MSCs that really have this dynamic component that allows them to keep improving productivity and quality. Otherwise, you just do the stuff that always is done, that you generate these specific policies for MIPES, right? And basically they just don't get nothing.
Before we wrap up, Piero, I wanted to ask one last question about economic research. You mentioned earlier that given your background in finance, maybe you weren't as up to date on the literature, but I was wondering whether you felt like any of the economic research you did come across provided answers to the types of questions you did have as a minister.
It's a very tough question, right? Because I think some stuff that had been written, particularly by people like Danny Roderick and Chuck Sable and some stuff by Ricardo Hausmann stuff, I think was useful, no? But I was not fully aware. I was not really aware of that research, right? It's funny because I became a lot more familiar with some of this modern industrial policy literature and experimentalist governance, right, after I left. So I was able to match the literature with the action, right? But I really was, I would say, in terms of external influences, I was influenced by some conversations more than research with Ricardo Hausmann, also talking about this emphasis on execution as opposed to create or diagnosis, right? The coordination issues, some stuff with Ernest Stein and the IDB. But overall, I wasn't too impressed in general with the development literature, even now, right? I am not sure a lot of the academic literature focuses on the right stuff. Probably, I'm sure it would be impossible for me to publish something on these topics because you need a lot of econometrics and stuff. We write some stuff on the quality hurdle with Chuck Sable that we have been unable to publish because it's so different from the standards. And so you can write something that makes zero sense, zero impact, but you put some regressions and write and use some data and then you get it in some of these journals, but they're useless. So I'm sorry, I don't know if I'm too tough, but I think I'm realistic in the sense that many stuff is not that useful, right?
Yeah, it's a harsh but important perspective, I think.
But some, I mean, guys like Chuck or Danny are really fantastic. That when I read the stuff that Chuck had written or Danny had written, it really looked as if they had been in common. So that stuff is super useful.
This has been Ideas in Development. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.